This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Bill Gormley. Bill is the chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement. And he's also the president of the Gormley Group. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. I'm glad to be back and I'm pretty excited about the topics I'm sure you're going to put in front of us today.
Well, yeah, it's an exciting time in government procurement, or a challenging or interesting time. We got sequestration down the road, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. But, today, right now, my first topic is, last Thursday, the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, GAO, the Government Accountability Office, gave the procurement community a big Valentine in terms of taking interagency management of interagency contracting off the high-risk list. And I'd like to first get your reaction to that, and then we'll dive into it a little bit.
Well, first thing, taking it off the high risk list is important. At least it's an important first step, Roger, from the standpoint of there's an opportunity, I think. I'll use the word relax. It may not sound, I don't want to overplay that, but I think it'll relax the agencies in giving, now providing some direction on contract duplication. The fact that there's interagency contracting is off the list now gives people, I think, hopefully some time to really look at and pay more attention to the opportunity of contract or contract vehicles that have already been awarded that they can utilize.
Right. I think it's, to me, when I think about it, I think about it in terms of confidence in the system. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a vote of confidence in, interagency contracting that, over the last decade, a number of steps have been taken to try to ensure, that those they work and they're accountable and you understand what you're doing if you're somebody using them. I think there's an opportunity, to your point, that this could set a framework in terms of confidence of those contracts to try to further address contract duplication.
And I think it's actually, while you were talking there, I was trying to think of when's the last time we kind of had some good news in contracting.
That's a good point. This is good news.
This is good news. When we talk contracting, there's always some contentious, issue or something's occurred that seems improper or something like that. But this is acting. Hats off to GAO for providing some good news. And maybe that's why it was done on Valentine's Day.
Oh, well, like I said, it was a big Valentine. Well, also, I want to say, it's hats off to the procurement community when you stop and think about it, whether it's the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy, GSA played its role as well, and the Chief Acquisition Officers Council, the FAR Council. I mean, really interagency contracting and trying to address concerns that were raised by audit reports or things that were discovered that were going on that, let's say, may have been problematic from some respects. There was a concerted, disciplined effort over a period of time to try to address those. And, it's like your point about good news stories. I mean, here's something where the government sort of collectively tried to work on something and made a difference.
Something got done in D.C.
Hey, well, how about that?
But right? I think to your point, Roger, and it's an excellent point. So I'll just expound upon it a little bit here, is that the fact that GAO issued the report doesn't mean GAO did it. It's a findings, and it's a findings of a cumulative effort within the acquisition community throughout government, both DOD and civilian agencies. So, hats off to them, to your point. And I think from GAO really, taking the time to get in behind, what changes have occurred, and then ultimately, publish the report, which indicates let's take this off the list and let the people manage their programs now.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things that's interesting, and I get your thoughts on this, is this issue, and I think you touched on it a little bit earlier, is moving forward. What does it mean? I mean, I know, DPAP is actually conducting a review of its policies and procedures around interagency contracting. You know, I think that's a great step, something that they definitely, it's a good thing that they're doing. To your point, how do you think that over time, I mean, it's not going to have an immediate effect, but what do you think in terms of, to your point, what does confidence in interagency contracting mean for the community and for contractors, for government?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the standpoint of, you know, what it would be the short-term impact versus long-term. I think short-term is, you know, their procurements are already moving along. I don't see any change there. I think it would be an exception, I think, if there was a change based on the findings here. I think, though, but moving forward, Roger, it gives agencies an opportunity, or I think, and from the acquisition, you know, when you get into the acquisition planning process, I think it's always important now when they look at this thing, look at that item that on their acquisition plan says, you know, is there an opportunity to go elsewhere to acquire whatever they're buying, their requirements elsewhere? I think that gives this a real great opportunity for agencies to look and see if there are other contract vehicles available. I mean, you and I, and I'm sure the viewers know, we're big advocates of the GSA.
Viewers, Bill.
Viewers.
Listeners.
I view my radio, but anyway.
Okay. That's good. That's
right. So anyway, as far as, you know, the GSA programs, and that's what GSA was set up for, and for other agencies who are offering kind of a shared services acquisition program, Roger, I think this is a great opportunity for, in the case of GSA, you know, been around since 1949, you know, this is their sweet spot. And I think for them, this is a huge green light.
Right. And I think I couldn't agree with you more. And I think, you know, it sort of goes to the idea of strategic acquisition and like looking at what's the most efficient and effective approach to acquiring these goods and services. And, you know, clearly, and we hear it all the time, we hear it from industry and government, like there's too many of these contract vehicles in there for the same or similar services. And I have a limited pool of bid and proposal, contract administration, you know, funds. And, you know, I've got to chase every potential opportunity because I don't know if I don't bid on it, I'll be locked out of a market. There's just that risk. It's almost like an insurance policy for something that may or may not happen when, you know, if you have a pre-existing vehicle, you could do a, you know, much quicker competition and task order level.
And I think with the GAO, the timing of the GAO report and the sequestration excitement.
Yeah, the S word.
Yeah, that's right. We'll get the S curve, but anyway, we'll talk about that later. But anyway, on the sequestration, I think now, you know, I think one thing is going to, that has the government has the opportunity here is to really reduce its cost of contracting. And I think, you know, talking about the GSA and shared services, the other folks who have the authority, it really now, I think, you know, embraces that more from a policy standpoint, that, you know, go find other vehicles instead of us recreating it. It just and in that in of itself, to be honest with you, Roger, is sort of a way of looking at strategic sourcing.
Yeah.
When agencies are not doing as many of their own repetitive contracts and not using established source of supply, they're actually moving requirements into an existing contract vehicle. And it does I know it's not the literal definition of strategic sourcing, but that does build the government's requirements within a contract vehicle. Therefore, there's an opportunity for government to have a good representation of requirements and from a negotiating standpoint.
Well, yeah, it's good points. And you've brought up another S word or two S words, strategic sourcing. So, and I know we're going to have a good conversation of that. So, and we've got about a minute left in this segment. So I'll let you start. And when you think of strategic sourcing as someone who worked in the government for many, many years. Yes, many years. We'll be polite. What do you think of when you think of strategic sourcing?
You know, it goes in and out of vogue in government. I hate putting in those terms, but from an acquisition practice, strategic sourcing is a valid way of any customer who has a need that can meet certain requirements. It's the appropriate way to buy. Okay. I think what happens unfortunately, many times, I'll step back for a minute. Typically, when you do strategic sourcing, you know what your requirements are, and you have the data prior to that for your market research, and it's your data, and then you use your data, establish your requirements, and normally you enter into a relationship. So whether it's a manufacturing company and they want to have suppliers, they're going to know what that supplier is going to provide them. The supplier wants to know what the specs are, what the requirements are, what the quantity is, and when they want it. That is pure strategic sourcing, and even where they just-in-time inventory type thing. So from the government uses the term strategic sourcing. I think they use it more as an identifier of what they like to do, but the government just doesn't have the systems in place. It's not a criticism. It's just they don't have that in place, and unfortunately, they use industry as a data source for them. And I still know that there's value in strategic sourcing. I think what the lessons have learned so far and the impact it's had, because the government has.
Okay, Bill, and just hold that thought.
It's going to be difficult. But go ahead.
Please, yeah, okay. Hold that thought. We have to do a little strategic sourcing advertising, I guess, right? So, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with Bill Gormley. Bill is the chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement, and we'll talk a little bit more strategic sourcing after the break. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bill Gormley. Bill is the chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement. He is also the president of the Gormley Group. And Bill, when we took the break, we were talking strategic sourcing and data. So I'll let you pick up.
Well, I think the carry on with that, I think the data element, I know it's very important. Industry recognizes it. Government has been always very hungry for data. And I guess I always kind of go back to, this is pretty much historical data. And strategic sourcing, a lot of that has to do with known requirements moving forward. And so I think that takes a little bit away from the pure commercial definition of strategic sourcing, Roger. And then plus, when you get into it, it's just not. When the government takes, or the way the government measures strategic sourcing in many ways is the actual reduction in unit price or whatever they're buying compared to what it was before they did this strategic sourcing initiative. And I think, that hopefully, they start to look at what is the total overall cost.
Right.
And the total overall cost means what does it cost to do this? Because that doesn't come.
Nothing's free, right?
Yeah, zero.
And data is not a free good, right?
Data is not free either. And I think from the standpoint, the other obligation that that the federal government has is in the socioeconomic area. So from a commercial standpoint, yes, socioeconomics are addressed in a different way. But from the government, where they have mandates of certain percentages under socioeconomic categories, this does have an impact on that. And then there's a cost to that, to overall society type thing. So there's a lot.
The government actually has more challenges, I think.
They do.
The private sector.
That's what I was going to say. Right. I want to give, this is not a knock against. It's just that, hey, folks, this is a lot going on here. And I think, but my point is, don't make it seem so simple as we're just going to measure unit prices, because it goes beyond that. There are ramifications elsewhere.
Right, you were sort of talking total acquisition cost or total cost of ownership, something like that.
Total cost of ownership.
Right, and the way I always visualize it, Bill, is like it's like a pyramid or a glacier, right? You got, the part that's above, or an iceberg, that's what I'm thinking of. That's a term. It's the iceberg. The part you see is the price. Mm-hmm. And then, 90% of the iceberg's below the waterline, and that's all the other costs that go to, developing requirements and coordination and the actual conducting of the acquisition to lead to that part that you actually see, which is the price paid.
Yeah,
does
exactly.
that make any sense there, Bill?
Of course it does.
Oh, thank you.
But I think it's...
You can come back.
That's right, thank you. But I think it's also recognized that where the government will award to several entities their strategic sourcing for the same, and then they'll go further, and either in some cases may even want to recompete it. But I think right now they've gone with the unit price of each one. So, I mean, there's... you know, I think we started out here is a strategic sourcing, a valid acquisition initiative. And the answer is yes, unquote, you know, just definitely. And I think the other side is, how does it get implemented, or is it being misidentified? I'm not sure what else you would call it, to be fair to everybody here, because I think it's already been branded. But I think what we don't want to, you know, we don't want to fool ourselves and then take credit for something where it's actually overall costing the government more money.
Right. And that's so, I mean, to me, that's what you're saying is the metrics have to be that total overall cost, total acquisition cost to acquire that good or service.
And at some point, there's going to be a technology change. So of what one's buying. So we have to be careful of that, allow new items or services. It sounds like the government wants to look at service, but allow these to come in play here.
Yeah. You know, and you're saying that, especially about the technology, I hearken back to the, early 90s, and it was sort of a form of strategic sourcing when you stop and think about it, is that the government used to do these massive like IDIQ contracts for IT with single contractors covering multiple years, and they'd have estimated quantities and that sort of, and they issued the challenge the government always had was like, how do you change out that technology? And you know, they're always doing change orders and things like that, and you know, it seems to me that's a great point in terms of how do you create a flexible tool that you can use, but you still get an opportunity to achieve savings for the taxpayer.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, show you how young I am. I remember Desktop 1, Desktop 2. From DOD. But anyway, DOD's initiatives and their objectives is sort of along strategic sourcing, to be honest with you.
Yep.
But what they to our earlier earlier discussion on this topic, you know, they wreck good for DOD. They force industry or force their partners to recognize DOD as a power buyer for commercial products at that time, Roger. But what they also came to the conclusion fairly quickly is, hey, we're buying technology that's ended.
Sure.
And that's why we're getting a good deal on it. And so now all that's changed. So they're doing what's right, and they're maintaining their contract relationships to be right with, you know, mirror to mirror, so to speak, as far as when things change, they're right with it from a supplier to customer standpoint.
And another thing I wanted to ask you about is just, you know, that in terms of the current sort of strategic sourcing approaches, most of them have been using the GSA Schedules program. I just someone who, you know, who's long associated with the GSA Schedules. I just, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we have enough time here, but my thoughts are,
I got two more segments here.
That's right.
So.
My take on it using the schedules, I view that the schedules program fundamentally is a strategic sourcing acquisition vehicle as a program.
Okay.
And I think the government, and the reason why is for the schedules themselves are set up in very broad categories of hosting commercial products and services. So when GSA in the OFPP and the administration and current administration went through and said, okay, strategic sourcing, these are the things that we're going to look at. They're all commercial, and the government is smart, and it tried not to write technical requirements for what they wanted.
Absolutely.
Okay. So there's hundreds of thousands of products in the office side. So they align themselves with, you know, the right vehicle, the schedules program. And then from that, you know, negotiated BPAs. You know, my feeling on pretty strong feelings is that, you know, there needs to be a guaranteed minimum to really get a good deal. And I think that's still lacking. I think there's that we're a big buyer type mentality, and the big buyer mentality is fine. But what I'll also say is the government market as a pie, Roger, the pie itself is getting, you know, it's going from a 12-inch to a 9-inch pie. And so the market is still big, but the slice is getting smaller.
So you're saying we're all going on a diet.
And, you know, we probably need to. I like that line. Maybe we need to. That's right.
To your point, I guess what you're saying is that the idea of, you know, and it goes back, you know, 10 years, the use of like letters of commitment, right. You know, where agencies would say, yes, we will use this, or, you know, or the letters, depending how they're written, the health qualifiers in them, or they're, it's like, who knows? That approach, it'd be, you know, to create greater economic incentive to getting better deals from the private sector. You're convinced that use of guaranteed minimums or a volume commitment of some sort is the way to go?
Yeah, I think volume commitment is sort of a no-brainer, to be quite honest with you, because there's still not a commitment there. But once the government gets up there, it incentivizes the government internally to
utilize it as well, right?
That's right.
To meet their contractual obligations.
Exactly. So there, you know, I think that would be, you know, we use that quite a bit when I was, you know, involved with the schedules program. We would negotiate volume-based discounts just during the course of a normal basic award, mm-hmm. just to fill that gap of uncertainty. We'd say, hey, we're going to do 5 million. Industry would say, oh, I'm not seeing it, so we'll give you a discount for $500,000. And I'm like, okay, what additional discount would you give us if we up that commitment? Well, it wasn't really a commitment, but it was a forecast. If once we got to volume based discounts, basically what it was, it became cumulative. The government overall got a better deal.
As there was an incentive, there's incentive on both sides. Best incentive to give the better deal. Yeah. And incentive to get the deal.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. I think they call it win-win.
Yeah. No, it's win-win-win. Win for the government, contractors, and the taxpayer.
Okay.
Right now, hey, you know. But right now we have to take a break so we can have a win-win for the station. So, you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And my guest is Bill Gormley. And when we come back, we'll talk further about a little bit about strategic sourcing, maybe a little bit about what sequestration may or may not mean or currently means. You're listening Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bill Gormley. Bill is the chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement. He's also the president of the Gormley Group. And Bill, I guess we're on S's today. So the next S happens to be sequestration. So I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, what you're seeing in the market and, you know, sort of what's going on. Or what your predictions are for what it means in the second half of the year?
Yeah, I'm not going to be laying any totally unknown, you know, opinion here that people haven't discussed already. But what I will say, Roger,
that's a great qualifier, Bill.
That's right. Keep your radio on.
Right.
But seriously, today when I was talking this morning talking to a company, and you know they're trying to identify, you know, the rest of their year. You know, they did their business plan, you know, last August for 2013 as an example, you know, one of many, you know, thousands of government contractors, and also it impacts the civilian and commercial business as well. But, you know, they're like, you know, they're in Q1 finishing up, you know, getting, yeah, they're in their first part of Q1 right now. And they're trying to figure out, you know, and they're seeing they're staying close to their customer, which they should, to see, you know, what the impact is or what word they're getting with inside that customer's agency or department as far as spending. They're seeing, you know, people are kind of holding back on new requirements, still indicating, hey, you know, there's a need for it. You know, we got you under contract. We just have to see how this is going to work out, you know, and what we may need to take off the table or not do. You know, that sets off a cascade of uncertainty, you know, within this small company. And And you think of that versus corporations, the cascade that goes on is much larger, you know?
Right.
And so here you go, uncertainty in a lot of ways. And so this becomes real. So as an example, the reason that they were talking to me is they're like, hey, you know, there's things that we'd like to do here, but we're not going to hire somebody. So it's better for us to, you know, to buy as we need. And so it's starting to set in now, and it may end up, you know, not knowing where sequestration is actually, you know, what's going to occur. I don't think anybody does. That's probably the one thing we do know. Nobody.
Right, that's true. It's too early. Yeah, it's too early. Scary. We're not 24 right. hours yeah, before the right. deadline,
yeah,
right?
Congress needs to do a business plan and stick by it. But anyways, that's a whole nother one. But I think what's important there, Roger, is that I think there could be a very interesting traditional year-end experience with government. And from a contractor standpoint and buying. And I think it's really going to get, as we indicated earlier, you know, the pie is going to shrink in order for companies to maintain the same market size. Their slice is going to have to increase within that smaller pie. You think of it in those terms. So when you look towards, you know, the fourth quarter here, you know, July, August, and September, you know, there's going to be a flurry of just activity. It's just going to mean what's the size of those activities.
Right. Could be a lot of activity at smaller sizes.
Yeah.
Right. So you're sort of saying.
Right. And I would.
Because there is pent up. There's going to be pent up demand to your point about things being delayed. It's just a question of what the size of those delays. I mean, what size is when they actually come out. Is that
right? I mean, the government's going to use everything out of the refrigerator and go to the freezer.
Right. Yes, right.
And so what we had to
pulling out the ice cubes, right?
That's right. So what we got to figure out is when it gets to the point they got to hit a reorder button somewhere. Right. And I think that's the fourth quarter. And I think that's going to be when you're going to see, you know, a lot. And the key is going to be whether the government's going to have the capacity to get it out. And, I'm a strong advocate of the GSA programs. And I think this is where GSA, you know, should be looking at, you know, what's going to happen in the third and fourth quarter and say, how are we going to, you know, what vehicles do we have? You know, they have over 18,000 vehicles just, you know, ready to roll in the schedules program that can help people. And getting back to the earlier discussions that we had,
right.
I think is a great model to be able to host those unknown demands and when those demands are going to be issued.
Right. And well, to your point, you know, let's go back to our first segment. We talked about contract duplication, interagency contracting. It seems to me that, you know, when people want to conduct, which they're going to have to, very quick, streamlined competitions for requirements, there's an installed base of shared services there. I'm using all the cliches, Bill.
Yeah.
Those government-wide contracting programs that they have the opportunity to use to get the competition, to get, you know, their requirements done. So it almost like further, you know, it's not just the, so it's almost you're starting to see, you know, things coalesce around, hey, maybe it's time that we really do need to press a delete button on some of these contracts and also just reinvigorate, you know, and put some additional resources in to interagency contracting, I would hope.
Yeah, well, Dan Tengerlini, as the current acting administrator, and has really, I think, early on talked about, you know, recognizing GSA as a shared services provider, and I think the time is to your point is aligning very nicely with his statement and ultimately, I think, a vision for GSA. So, you know, this is a great opportunity. But I have another S for you.
A couple S's.
I just thought about it. I just jotted them down while you were talking.
All right.
Sharing savings.
Okay. What about sharing savings, Bill?
Sharing savings has probably been around for a long time. I know when Tom Davis was in Congress, he's
a big champion of it.
Yep. Big advocate of sharing savings. And it's just, it's very interesting. I'd like to see another positive GAO report come out.
All right.
How about that? Maybe that would put some context around sharing savings. But I think, you know, basically from the opportunity the government has with all the financial unknowns, constraints, however you want to categorize, we know the government's not going to get bigger from a money, you know, standpoint. So it's sharing savings plays right in to the environment that the government is facing, Roger. And I think sharing savings from the listeners, is that what they have, or viewers, how we got?
We got listeners here, okay. I think, Bill.
You're actually viewing inside your...
I hope they're not seeing me right now.
That's right. So anyway, on the...
It's not a pretty picture.
Right. From a listener standpoint, I think sharing savings, probably a lot of people actually probably listen to this understand it, but it's really where... an entity, a company in the government or industry in government, we'll keep it a broader, recognize that if there's an opportunity for a company to say, hey, we can save you X dollars, that the government, can accept that type of relationship and then provide, if they save 30% in whatever they would agree upon, then the government would give them 10% of the 30%. I'm just giving percentages, right, right. Not set sure. percentages, but as an example. And I think where the government, everybody sits down. When I was in government, and we all had meetings on it. And what happens is that I always thought money was green. But,
yes.
but the color of money changes from one fiscal year to another.
Right, right. And different activities, different purposes, different, all kinds of good stuff
and
like that.
And so that really inhibits the government from being, a better buyer, a better, from an acquisition standpoint. So that's sharing savings, I think, is something hopefully, maybe this is, OFPP is just focused on strategic sourcing. I think they could save, I'd challenge you right here. I bet you can save more on shared services than you can strategic sourcing.
You mean share and savings?
Share and savings, excuse me.
Yeah. I think you're probably right.
Get down to it. You're talking energy consumption. You're talking some major cost areas.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I know there is, that's one area, energy savings performance contracts is an area that's ongoing right now. It's in the energy department does do that. But I agree with you. I think there's an opportunity there with the fiscal constraints that looking at flexibilities and trying to sort of jumpstart, share and savings type models. I remember I was in the government back in the dark ages too when we were looking at this. And not only to your point, it was about money and the color of money and what you do, how you pay the contractor, but also is the issue the government always had a hard time figuring out what the baseline is to start from. What were the actual requirements? And maybe you start small and do a couple projects and demonstrate some, great return, and then you try to roll something out, and you have a business plan for it, Bill.
Yeah, right. But the president recently covered this in his State of the Union that we have to invest, and I think to your point about a baseline, I think for some, and you touched on a key one, energy. I think have hire the government could actually hire a third party and do an IVV. An independent verification validation to reach a baseline, and then have someone come in off that baseline, and then the folks coming in looking at the IVV report, which would either agree with it or not, they agree with it, then they can say we can save you X off of it. Then that right there, I think would be a good example, and I think it'd be a great pilot opportunity. The government's interested in reducing energy anyway. They may as well try sharing savings.
Right. So I know I think you have another S, but we'll have to wait after the break.
Is that stop or what?
Yeah. So because right now we have to do some advertising. We have to do the big A. So when we come back, we'll be talking more to Bill Gormley, Chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Well, welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bill Gormley. Bill is the chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement. He is also the president of the Gormley Group. And Bill, I guess we'll keep on the S theme today. And I know you'd love to talk about the S curve. Yeah. Maybe we will do a whole show on that. I think that would be a piece of cake for you. But
I think that's more visual. All right.
Yeah, that's true. Good. And we don't have viewers, do we, Bill?
That's right.
So let's just, I think, one of the things that I've been interested in talking about is strategic acquisition. What does that mean? There's a lot of focus on, I guess strategic sourcing, but I think it's bigger than that. But I'd like to get your thoughts.
Sure. Well, Roger, you are a former government attorney.
Don't hold that against me out there.
So, but that background, this will be an interesting conversation. I don't think, at least in my term in government, we never really looked at strategic acquisition And I think you're not going to read that anywhere as far as a government identification of in the career of acquisition. But I think it does align itself when I think of strategic acquisition, Roger. I mean, the key to any procurement is fundamentally the requirements, knowing what you're going to buy, how much you're going to buy, when you need it, or to at least set up a contract vehicle that can host some unknowns, but yet provide enough information, meaning requirements, that allows industry to determine, number one, can they meet your needs, the parts that's known anyway, and then I may have said this on your show before, but there's three elements of pricing from an industry standpoint that are common, I think, in any offer that they, when they respond to an RFP or an RFQ, and that's things that affect it is like, their inventory, whether it's in product, inventory level, or where resources, people for services. So you have, what's my inventory level? Am I overstocked in either one, or do I think I'm going to get out of a contract pretty soon? And do I need to backfill and create that, keep that demand coming in? So that becomes a key factor in making those decisions on price. And the other one is market penetration. As a company in reviewing an RFP from an entity, am I already in that agency or department? How well do I know them? And then that plays into how comfortable am I with the requirements and how well does this entity describe such? And that helps reduce your risk to the extent that it can help. But I mean, that's a key part. And the other one is sales goals. I mean, how am I doing as a company? How bad do I want to go for this? Which, well, on one hand creates competition, but on the other, it's I think I've kind of tried to paint the picture here. It's all around requirements and the best knowledge that I have of basically the profile of the customer or potential customer. So
sure.
So requirements long answer to your question, I guess. Requirements is a key part to strategic sourcing. And from an industry standpoint, and also in government should be looking at, how can I reduce my internal processing costs by having a relationship, a BPA or a contract with an entity, and how does that, the government should see savings for that. And it gets back to an earlier conversation we had, Roger, on strategic sourcing. What is the total, what is it costing the government to do strategic sourcing and measure it by the total cost of ownership, just not, you saved 5% or 10% or whatever the number is. That number is not a true number. It's only a component of what the total overall taxpayer cost is to perform that function or
right.
task.
Right. So I'm interested to follow up on that. And I'm gratified to hear you focus on requirements, and requirements development, because I can tell you that, when I was on the Sarah panel back and we did a report, and the first chapter's on commercial practices, and we looked at commercial firms and what they did and what were best practices. And number two, one we identified was commercial firms spend a lot of time figuring out their requirements, because the clearer they are, and the better defined they are, the better competition they got, and ultimately the better outcome they got with their partner, whoever they ended up contracting with. I mean, so there was a big focus on that. And I think that's something that, the government, has lost a lot of that capability over the years as the downsizing, we had the post-Cold War, downsizing of folks, and then you had to ramp up and with post 9/11, and now we're trying to address the acquisition workforce and that sort of thing. But I think that's an area where the government can't lose sight that they've got to be able to well define requirements.
Yeah, and I think the more, I think a lot of what we talk about, Roger, has to do with commercial items.
Yes.
And so I think the opportunity for the government to kind of go a little bit further on the government's capability you know, the government's got a significant amount of capability. There's no question about it. But I think, you know, with a smaller acquisition workforce, to your point, I think a lot of resources were used to develop, you know, what used to be federal specifications back
that's
in the
true.
Day.
That's a very good point. You know, yeah. I remember seeing those things.
Right.
You know, we all kinds of
we would tell you
about
how
them.
To make it. And right. Maybe it didn't work, but we tell you. But anyway, but the government, in fairness, the government's moved away from,
yes.
you know, actually developing the technical requirements for commercial items. And I think the government is saved. And I think that's one thing the government really hasn't measured. Maybe they're not interested in it. And I'm not trying to be, you know, maybe right. they're not seeing the value of studying, you know, how costs have actually gone down.
Yes.
There's clearly a gap between, I mean, there's a lot of you know, new entry people in the government that bring a lot of new market ideas, just based from social media and so forth, but that weren't around, you know, not that many number of years ago, to be quite honest with you. So you have the new workforce coming in, and there's actually a gap, you know, between the management side, based on the reductions. I think it was over 25% reduction back in the 90s. And so, you know, the government is still hurting from that.
Yeah, they've hired up, but they've not back to it.
Correct.
You know, right.
But I think when you get to the commercial, acquiring commercial items, I think the government has a great opportunity to really utilize what is working in industry and within the industry that where it's working, the government's requirements are no different.
Right.
So whether it's, you know, on the commercial products and services, and then the government just needs to continue to leverage that and be smarter on how they buy.
So where does LPTA, low price technically acceptable, fit in your world?
LPTA, I don't know. It's, you know, personally, I just don't like hearing it because I think it degrades, you know, the government's opportunity to get quality and to maintain quality into what it wants to buy. I don't think the government's interested in having lesser quality, and I think low price definitely acceptable. It just has an inference that follows it around that, you know, we just want something that's low price and yet, you know, meet our minimal needs. And I think the minimal needs of the government is kind of gets back to when you look at total overall cost of ownership. You may get it, you know, you may get a great.
I like you using that term, minimal needs. I like that. Actually, it's a good way to put it when you're talking low price, technically acceptable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you may get a, I was going to go toilet paper. I'm not going to do that. You may get a writing tablet. Okay. And maybe the writing tablet, you know, you can buy a 50 sheet or a 75 sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope you get a better deal on a 50 sheet, but maybe you don't. But I was just trying to. So, they may buy a 50 sheet and say we saved money when you know they're going to use the other 25. I mean, the government has not gone paperless yet. So,
right.
I mean, it's that. I know that's kind of a out there example, but it is an idea that I think we need to think, and the government as a buyer should be conscious of this LPTA. Don't. You know, don't get fooled by it from a government buyer standpoint. You have to look at what your needs are. Are they reoccurring? What's the life? What's the warranty?
How quickly do you need it?
Yeah, and the frequency.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, can your relationship with a company, do they have do they have the inventory so you don't have to inventory it? There's a cost of there's a cost of that square foot of that closet in a government building for storing things. And if it's out in an industry and they can give you a decent price on it, then you know, you don't have to add a closet.
You can
open it up.
Right.
You know, telework it or something. Yeah.
Well, we got only about a minute left, Bill, but I wanted to ask you, like, just to give me your thoughts, if you could pick one thing you would do to try to improve the acquisition system as it currently stands, what would that be?
I consider that an honor you asked me that. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Hey.
I'm not sure how much weight we're going to have here, but we'll try it.
Okay.
But yeah, here's kind of how I see it. I think with the, and it sort of ties into, you know, the workforce thing. I think the whole acquisition community, you know, is really lacking really good leadership that understands government contracting and the environment that the government has to play in. It is not an easy environment. I was involved in it for decades, and and went through a lot of things, and real proud of the career and so forth. But there's a leadership deficit, and I think as part of a leadership skill that I think also you have to be conscious of is recognizing that industry is not, it shouldn't be an adversarial relationship with industry. And that's part of the leadership skill. And I think the government gets a greater return on having relationships with its partners. So right. Leadership and the appropriate skills.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you so much. And I want to thank my guest, Bill Gormley, chairman of the Coalition for Government Procurement and the president of the Gormley Group. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.